Chapter 6. Making More by Making Less. The Evolution of Female Menopause. Section 2. The aging, or senescence, as biologists call it, of the female reproductive tract cannot be profitably considered in isolation from other aging processes. Our eyes, kidneys, heart, and all other organs and tissues also senesce. But that aging of our organs is not physiologically inevitable. Or at least it's not inevitable that they senesce as rapidly as they do in the human species, because the organs of some turtles, clams, and other species remain in good condition much longer than ours do. Physiologists and many other researchers on aging tend to search for a single all-encompassing explanation of aging. Popular explanations hypothesized in recent decades have invoked the immune system, free radicals, hormones, and cell division. In reality, though, all of us over 14 know that everything about our bodies gradually deteriorates, and not just our immune systems and our defenses against free radicals. Although I have had a less stressful life and better medical care than most of the world's nearly 6 billion people, I can still tick off the aging processes that have already taken their toll on me by age 59: impaired hearing at high pitch, failure of my eyes to focus at short distances, less acute senses of smell and taste, loss of one kidney, tooth wear, less flexible fingers, and so on. My recovery from injuries is already slower than it used to be. I had to give up running because of recurrent calf injuries. I recently completed a slower recovery from a left elbow injury, and now I have just injured the tendon of a finger. Ahead of me, if the experience of other men is any guide, lies the familiar litany of complaints, including heart disorders, clogged arteries, bladder trouble, joint problems, prostate enlargement, memory loss, colon cancer, and so on. All that deterioration is what we mean by aging. The basic reasons behind this grim litany are easily understood by analogy to human-built structures. Animal bodies, like machines, tend to deteriorate gradually or become acutely damaged with age and use. To combat those tendencies, we consciously maintain and repair our machines. Natural selection ensures that our body unconsciously maintains and repairs itself. Both bodies and machines are maintained in two ways. First, we repair a part of a machine when it is acutely damaged. For example, we fix a car's punctured tire or bashed-in fender, and we replace its brakes or tires if they become damaged beyond repair. Our body similarly repairs acute damage. The most visible example is wound repair, when we cut our skin, but molecular repair of damaged DNA and many other repair processes go on invisibly inside us. Just as a ruined tire can be replaced, our body has some capacity to regenerate parts of damaged organs, such as by making new kidney, liver, and intestinal tissue. That capacity for regeneration is much better developed in many other animals. If only we were like starfish, crabs, sea cucumbers, and lizards, which can regenerate their arms, legs, intestines, and tail, respectively. The other type of upkeep of machines and bodies is regular or automatic maintenance to reverse gradual wear, regardless of whether there has been any acute damage. For example, at times of scheduled maintenance, we change our car's motor oil, spark plugs, fan belt, and ball bearings. Similarly, our body constantly grows new hair, replaces the lining of the small intestine every few days, replaces our red blood cells every few months, and replaces each tooth once in our lifetime. Invisible replacement goes on for the individual protein molecules that make up our bodies. How well you maintain your car, and how much money or resources you put into its maintenance, strongly influence how long it lasts. The same can be said of our bodies, not only with respect to our exercise programs, visits to the doctor, and other conscious maintenance, but also with respect to the unconscious repair and maintenance that our bodies do on themselves. Synthesizing new skin, kidney tissue, and proteins uses up a lot of biosynthetic energy. Animal species vary greatly in their investment in self-maintenance, hence in the rate at which they senesce. Some turtles live for over a century. Laboratory mice, living in cages with abundant food and no predators or risks, and receiving better medical care than any wild turtle, or the vast majority of the world's people, inevitably become decrepit and die of old age before their third birthday. There are aging differences even among us humans and our closest relatives, the great apes. Well-nourished apes living in the safety of zoo cages and attended by veterinarians rarely, if ever, live past age 60, while white Americans exposed to much greater danger and receiving less medical attention now live to an average of 78 years for men, 83 years for women. Why do our bodies unconsciously take better care of themselves than do apes' bodies? Why do turtles senesce so much more slowly than mice? We could avoid aging entirely, and, barring accidents, live forever if we went all out for repair and changed all the parts of our bodies frequently. We could avoid arthritis by growing new limbs, as crabs do, avoid heart attacks by periodically growing a new heart, and minimize tooth decay by regrowing new teeth 5 times, as elephants do, instead of just once, as we do. Some animals thus make a big investment in certain aspects of body repair, but no animal makes a big investment in all aspects, and no animal avoids aging entirely. Analogy to our cars again makes the reason obvious, the expense of repair and maintenance. Most of us have only limited amounts of money, which we are obliged to budget. We put just enough money into car repair to keep our car running as long as it makes economic sense to do so. When the repair bills get too high, we find it cheaper to let the old car die and buy a new one. Our genes face a similar trade-off between repairing the old body that contains the genes and making new containers for the genes, that is, babies. Resources spent on repair, whether of cars or of bodies, eat away at the resources available for buying new cars or making babies. Animals with cheap self-repair and short lifespans, like mice, can churn out babies much more rapidly than can expensive-to-maintain, long-lived animals like us, a female mouse that will die at the age of 2, long before we humans achieve fertility, has been producing 5 babies every 2 months since she was a few months old. That is, natural selection adjusts the relative investments in repair and reproduction so as to maximize the transmission of genes to offspring. The balance between repair and reproduction differs between species. Some species stint on repair and churn out babies quickly, but direly, like mice. Other species, like us, invest heavily in repair, live for nearly a century, and can produce a dozen babies in that time, if you are a Hutterite woman, or over 1,000 babies, if you are Emperor Muley the Bloodthirsty. Your annual rate of baby production is lower than the mouse's, even if you are Muley, but you have more years in which to do it. It turns out that an important evolutionary determinant of biological investment in repair, hence of lifespan, under the best possible conditions, is the risk of death from accidents and bad conditions. You don't waste money maintaining your taxi if you are a taxi driver in Tehran, where even the most careful taxi driver is bound to suffer major fender bender every few weeks. Instead, you save your money to buy the inevitable next taxi. Similarly, animals whose lifestyles carry a high risk of accidental death are evolutionarily programmed to stint on repair and to age rapidly, even when living in the well-nourished safety of a laboratory cage. Mice, subject to high rates of predation in the wild, are evolutionarily programmed to invest less in repair and to age more rapidly than similar-sized caged birds that in the wild can escape predators by flying. Turtles, protected in the wild by a shell, are programmed to age more slowly than other reptiles, while porcupines, protected by quills, age more slowly than mammals comparable in size. That generalization also fits us and our ape relatives. ancient humans, who usually remained on the ground and defended themselves with spears and fire, were at lower risk of death from predators or from falling out of a tree, and were arboreal apes. The legacy of the resultant evolutionary programming carries on today, in that we live for several decades longer than do zoo apes living under comparable conditions of safety, health, and affluence. We must have evolved better repair mechanisms and decreased rates of senescence in the last 7 million years since we parted company from our ape relatives, came down out of the trees, and armed ourselves with spears and stones and fire. Similar reasoning is relevant to our painful experience that everything in our bodies begins to fall apart as we grow older. Alas, that said truth of evolutionary design is cost-efficient. You would be wasting biosynthetic energy, which otherwise could go into making babies, if you kept one part of your body in such great repair that it outlasted all your other parts and your resultant expected lifespan. The most efficiently constructed body is the one in which all organs wear out at approximately the same time. The same principle, of course, applies to human-built machines, as illustrated in a story about that genius of cost-efficient automobile manufacture, Henry Ford. One day, Ford sent some of his employees to car junkyards, with instructions to examine the condition of the remaining parts in Model T Fords that had been junked. The employees brought back the apparently disappointing news that almost all components showed signs of wear. The sole exceptions were the kingpins, which remained virtually unworn. To the employees' surprise, Ford, instead of expressing pride in his well-made kingpins, declared that the kingpins were overbuilt and that in the future they should be made more cheaply. Ford's conclusion may violate our ideal of pride in workmanship, but it made economic sense. He had indeed been wasting money on long-lasting kingpins that outlasted the cars in which they were installed. The design of our bodies, which evolved through natural selection, fits Henry Ford's kingpin principle, with only one exception. Virtually every part of the human body wears out around the same time. The kingpin principle even fits men's reproductive tract, which undergoes no abrupt shutdown, but does gradually accumulate a variety of problems, such as prostate hypertrophy and decreasing sperm count, to different degrees in different men. The kingpin principle also fits the bodies of animals. Animals caught in the wild show few signs of age-related deterioration, because a wild animal is likely to die from a predator or accident when its body becomes significantly impaired. In zoos and laboratory cages, however, animals exhibit gradual age-related deterioration in every body part just as we do. That sad message applies to the female as well as the male reproductive tract of animals. Female rhesus macaques run out of functional eggs around age 30. Fertilization of eggs in aged rabbits becomes less reliable. An increasing fraction of eggs are abnormal in aging hamsters, mice, and rabbits. Fertilized embryos are increasingly unviable in aged hamsters and rabbits, and aging of the uterus itself leads to increasing embryonic mortality in hamsters, mice, and rabbits. Thus, the female reproductive tract of animals is a microcosm of the whole body, in that everything that could go wrong with age may in fact go wrong at different ages in different individuals. The glaring exception to the kingpin principle is human female menopause. In all women within a short age span, it shuts down decades before expected death, even before the expected death of many hunter-gatherer women. It shuts down for a physiologically trivial reason: the exhaustion of functional eggs that would have been easy to eliminate just by a mutation that slightly altered the rate at which eggs die or become unresponsive. Evidently, there was nothing physiologically inevitable about human female menopause, and there was nothing evolutionarily inevitable about it from the perspective of mammals in general. Instead, the human female, but not the human male, has become specifically programmed by natural selection, at some time within the last few million years, to shut down reproduction prematurely. That premature senescence is all the more surprising because it goes against an overwhelming trend. In other respects, we humans have evolved delayed rather than premature senescence. Theorizing about the evolutionary basis of human female menopause must explain how a woman's apparently counterproductive evolutionary strategy of making fewer babies could actually result in her making more babies. Evidently, as a woman ages, she can't do more to increase the number of people bearing her genes by devoting herself to her existing children, her potential grandchildren, and her other relatives than by producing yet another child. The evolutionary chain of reasoning rests on several cruel facts. One is the human child's long period of parental dependence, longer than in any other animal species. A baby chimpanzee starts gathering its own food as it becomes weaned by its mother. It gathers the food mostly with its own hands. Chimpanzee use of tools, such as fishing for termites with grass blades, or cracking nuts with stones, is of great interest to human scientists, but of only limited dietary significance to chimpanzees. The baby chimpanzee also prepares its food with its own hands. But human hunter-gatherers acquire most of their food with tools, such as digging sticks, nets, spears, and baskets. Much human food is also prepared with tools, husked, pounded, cut up, etc., and then cooked in a fire. We do not protect ourselves against dangerous predators with our teeth and strong muscles, as do other prey animals, but, again, with our tools. Even to wield all those tools is completely beyond the manual dexterity of babies, and to make the tools is beyond the abilities of young children. Tool use and tool making are transmitted not just by imitation, but by language, which takes over a decade for a child to master. As a result, a human child in most societies does not become capable of economic independence or adult economic function until his or her teenage years or twenties. Until then, the child remains dependent on his or her parents, especially on a mother, because, as we saw in previous chapters, mothers tend to provide more child care than do fathers. Parents are important not only for gathering food and teaching tool making, but also for providing protection and status within the tribe. In traditional societies, the early death of either the mother or the father prejudiced a child's life even if the surviving parent remarried because of possible conflicts with the step-parent's genetic interests. A young orphan who was not adopted had even worse chances of surviving. Hence a hunter-gatherer mother who already has several children risks losing some of her genetic investment in them if she does not survive until the youngest is at least a teenager. That one cruel fact underlying human female menopause becomes more ominous in the light of another cruel fact: the birth of each child immediately jeopardizes a mother's previous children because of the mother's risk of death in childbirth. In most other animal species, that risk is insignificant. For example, in one study encompassing 401 pregnant female rhesus macaques, only one died in childbirth. For humans in traditional societies, the risk was much higher and increased with age. Even in affluent, 20th century Western societies, the risk of dying in childbirth is 7 times higher for a mother over the age of 40 and for a 20-year-old mother. But each now child puts the mother's life at risk not only because of the immediate risk of death in childbirth, but also because of the delayed risk of death related to exhaustion by lactation, carrying a young child, and working harder to feed more mouths. Yet another cruel fact is that infants of older mothers are themselves increasingly unlikely to survive or be healthy because of age-related increases in the risks of abortion, stillbirth, low fetal weight, and genetic defects. For instance, the risk of a fetus carrying the genetic condition known as Down syndrome increases with the mother's age from 1 in 2,000 births for a mother under 30, 1 in 300 for a mother between the ages of 35 and 39, and 1 in 50 for a 43-year-old mother, to the grim odds of 1 in 10 for a mother in her late 40s. Thus, As a woman gets older, she is likely to have accumulated more children. She has also been caring for them longer, so she is putting a bigger investment at risk with each successive pregnancy. But her chances of dying in or after childbirth, and the chances that the fetus or infant will die or be damaged, also increase. In effect, the older mother is taking on more risk for less potential gain. That's one set of factors that would tend to favor human female menopause, and that would paradoxically result in a woman ending up with more surviving children by giving birth to fewer children. Natural selection has not programmed menopause into men because of three more cruel facts. Men never die in childbirth and rarely die while copulating, and they are less likely than mothers to exhaust themselves caring for infants. A hypothetically non-menopausal old woman who died in childbirth or while caring for an infant would thereby be throwing away even more than her investment in her previous children. That is, because a woman's children eventually begin producing children of their own, and those children count as part of the woman's prior investment. Especially in traditional societies, a woman's survival is important not only to her children, but also to her grandchildren. That extended role of postmenopausal women has been explored by Kristen Hawkes, the anthropologist, whose research on men's roles I discussed in Chapter 5. Hawkes and her colleagues studied foraging by women of different ages among the Hadza hunter-gatherers of Tanzania. The women who devoted the most time to gathering food, especially roots, honey, and fruit, were postmenopausal women. Those hard-working Hadza grandmothers put in an impressive 7 hours per day, compared to a mere 3 hours for teenagers and newbrides, and 4.5 hours for married women with young children. As one might expect, foraging returns, measured in pounds of food gathered per hour, increased with age and experience, so that mature women achieved higher returns than teenagers, but, interestingly, the grandmothers' returns were still as high as those of women in their prime. The combination of more foraging hours and an unchanged foraging efficiency meant that the postmenopausal grandmothers brought in more food per day than any of the younger groups of women, even though their large harvests were greatly in excess of what was required to meet their own personal needs, and they no longer had dependent young children to feed. Hawkes and her colleagues observed that the Hadza grandmothers were sharing their excess food harvest with close relatives, such as their grandchildren and grown children. As a strategy for transforming food calories into pounds of baby, it would be more efficient for an older woman to donate the calories to grandchildren and grown children rather than to infants of her own, even if she still could give birth, because the older mother's fertility would be decreasing with age anyway, whereas her own children would be young adults at peak fertility. Naturally, this food-sharing argument does not constitute the sole reproductive contribution of postmenopausal women in traditional societies. A grandmother also babysits her grandchildren, thereby helping her adult children churn out more babies bearing the grandmother's genes. In addition, grandmothers lend their social status to their grandchildren, as to their children,